Hi, listeners. This is your co-host, Mark Fraunfelder. Before we get started with this week's episode, I wanted to let you know that our discussion includes explicit talk about sex, and we use a lot of adult language. So keep that in mind before continuing to listen. I'd also like to take this opportunity to let you know that we've been producing a lot of excellent videos on our YouTube channel. If you haven't checked it out yet, please do so by going to youtube.com/cooltools. And if you like what you see, I'd be grateful if you hit the subscribe button. Thanks for listening, and here's our podcast with Susie Bright. Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Fraunfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is best-selling author Susie Bright. Susie is a pioneering, preeminent feminist sex writer and legendary audio producer. She's also reached peak satisfaction as a guest editor of Boing Boing and an early member of The Well. Susie is one of the world's most respected voices on sexual politics, as well as an award-winning author and editor who's produced and published thousands of the finest writers and journalists working in American literature and progressive activism today. Susie has written, I think, for Kevin at Whole Earth Cattle, our Whole Earth Review, and for my wife Carla at Craft Magazine. Susie, a huge pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you for giving me such a nice build-up. But really, the reason I'm on this show is that I share a love of tools and useful items that one sort of has a romance with. I think this is a very romantic show. We like to talk about our love affairs with the tools that transform our lives, and I couldn't be more just sort of tickled that you invited me.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you here. We're really, really excited to hear what you have for us, knowing that you have this love for tools. And one of the things that I know that you have an interest in is people who inherit tools from their grandmother, grandfather, their father, their mother. And maybe just to start off, did you ever inherit any tools from one of your grandparents or parents?
Yeah, I did. You know, at first I thought of it as something more butch, you know, like my lover, he has his grandpa's toolbox and he's so proud of it. He's always emerging from the shed, holding aloft some obscure item and saying, "Look, I told you this could never be found at Home Depot. And here it is, grandpa's toolbox saves the day again." And, you know, so I was like, yeah, that is cool. And I never really thought what my version of that was. But I would say with my mother, it's the fact that I inherited her sewing machine, her Singer sewing machine, which was the first thing she ever took out a loan on. Before she ever took out a loan on a car or a house, she got a sewing machine and made payments to Singer. And then I would say with my dad, my dad was a writer and editor, and he used to sit me on his lap at his big oak desk, which I'm sitting at right now as I'm talking to you. And he would let me hold a red pencil because I was little and I wasn't big enough to do the pen yet in case I made a mistake. He would let me hold a red pencil and try and find errors in the galleys back when you did that by hand. And he had a great love of pens, pencils, desk things, and we shared that obsession for the rest of our lives. I mean, you know, him and me in a stationery store, you know, we could do some major damage.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the kinds of tools that you're excited these days by. So obviously, stationery stores still turn you on, but what else is a tool that you're really excited by these days?
Well, another reason that I got to know Mark a little better is that his wife, Carla, invited me to be the sewing columnist for Craft Magazine for a few years, and it was a beautiful time for me to take that position because I came a little late to dressmaking and tailoring, but I fell in love with it. I had some great teachers, and one of the most important tools that I use every single day of my life is the Ginger Craft scissors. Now, I think a lot of your listeners know that having a cutting instrument, having a good scissors is, you know, priceless, really priceless. It's like having a decent knife on your belt. But this particular scissors, it's not as big as a scissors that you would imagine, you know, that's usually like 8-10 inches long, you know, with the long shears. This is short. And one of the things that is remarkable about it is that the points, as they call them, the very tip of the scissors, are vicious. I mean, if I was a mass murderer, I mean, these would be the scissors of choice. I mean, these, you know, like they, when you need to get to the very end of something and have a perfect, complete cut that is like, you know, you need to do a right angle or a V, and you cannot have one scintilla, you know, out of place, this is the scissors. The other thing it's good for, you know how so many things we buy these days come in really grotesque packaging and you just feel like you need a blowtorch to get it open? Yes. Again, the Ginger scissors, it's just like la la la, you know, chip chip chip, boop boop boop, it's gone. And another thing, you know, I always thought, well, eventually, I mean, I've had these scissors for 15 years and I thought I would eventually take them to, you know, one of those knife sharpening places and get them spruced up. Maybe, you know, the guy who comes to the farmer's market. They're magic. They never get dull. They never get dull. And they come, I mean, they feel good. They feel good in your hands. They're so small. And they have this little leather pouch that the tips go in that so you don't accidentally hurt somebody. And as you know, unless you really want to. And even the leather pouch feels like supple, lovely leather. Like they never made a, you know, like decided to do it in plastic. They have never gone cheap on these scissors. And I don't know why. I think this is one of these companies where I made the effort to write them a fan letter. And I would like to say that to everyone who loves a tool. You should know that if it's a good tool, it means that the people making it, even if you're, you know, like, who, you know, where the hell are these manufactured? Just write to them and say, I can't tell you how much it means to me that you've kept the quality of this going, even though everything in capitalism tells you not to, that you insist on your craftsmanship. Yeah. These are really artisanal scissors that are being sold on a mass scale.
Right. Someone told me that, particularly with scissors like this that you use for fabric, that if you have a scissors for fabric, you should never cut anything else but fabric with them. I don't know if that's really true.
Good point. Let me make a distinction. Although I use these in sewing, I actually don't use them for cutting out yardage because the best way to cut out yardage is a longer scissors where you can like do bigger cuts at a time, or if you do a slight tear on the warp or the weft and then just rip it, you're going to get a straight cut. And that is what you're going to do if you're doing yardage. If you're doing a complicated cutout on your pattern, use a bigger scissors and only use the Gingers when you're going in close for really small little cuts. I use the Ginger Craft scissors for other parts of sewing, like when I want to do the thread, I'm doing small decorative work, anything. It's kind of like Bruce Lee and Kung Fu. It's for when you're up close.
Okay, it's an up close weapon. All right. So tell us about another thing on your list. I think you maybe skipped over one, but we're talking about stationery stores. You have the Blackwing pencil as a favorite tool.
Yes.
What's about the black-winged pencil that you really, really love?
Yeah, when I was telling you about how my father, kind of trained me on his knee when it came to desk accoutrement, I was very glad that before he died, I was able to give him a box of black-wing pencils because I knew he would, it's almost like an asthma experience. You get the tingles all over, you start to flush, you've got goosebumps. This pencil, I'm holding one in my hand as I talk to you so that I can sort of feel it as I'm telling you. It is simply the creamiest, smoothest, most perfect texture on texture experience I've ever had in my life. I mean, this, it doesn't matter whether you're making a mark on some shitty little receipt that you got out of a parking machine or whether you're using linen paper, you know, this lead is just the right smoothness and composition that it makes writing a whole new thing. I mean, a lot of us have said to ourselves, oh gosh, since the advent of keyboards, my handwriting has really gone down the toilet. And that I was one of those people. I was like, wow, you know, I went to Catholic school. I used to get A's in handwriting. And now I can't even write I love you without, you know, some screw up as I'm using my hand. This pencil brought me back. I mean, I still am a fountain pen freak. I mean, I like pens. I really do. But this pencil, you know, it never, of course, it eventually goes down to a nub as you sharpen it, but you never have to refresh it. Or, you know, like, oh my God, it needs more ink, or I need to shake it. You know, no, the moment you place it on anything and you start to move, you have this effortless charcoal experience that is just heaven. I mean, people are fanatics about black wings. You meet someone who's using black wings, you're in the cult. There are people who will tell you about the 1990s when these things went out of business and people were paying $40 per pencil on eBay to get one of these. That's how crazy it was.
And so are most of the people are using it for drawing and sketching?
I don't know the statistics. My partner is an artist and he draws with them constantly, but I do daily notes for my editorial work and I do everything in pencil. I mean, I even signed a check in pencil last week just to see if I could get away with it and nobody said anything. When I need the most efficient way to write, like if I'm writing in my diary, if I'm writing a draft of an article, whenever I need my hand on a page, this is what I'm going to use. I even did my last book signing, I pulled out my Blackwing and I was wondering, oh, is somebody going to go, what are you using a pencil for? But, you know, I think people are so unfamiliar with the art of handwriting, they don't even realize it. But nobody said anything. And I can sign 100 books with my autograph so fast with this pencil. It's just so beautiful. For your listeners, I sent a couple of links. They're going to notice that you can get different kinds of black wings. They come in a couple of different colors, and you can get ones that are slightly firmer than the other. It's not like you're going to go wrong, but for those people who've never had this experience and they want the orgasmic black wing initiation, just get the classic Blackwing Palomino. Isn't that a pretty name? It's like the name of a horse, a beautiful horse. Yeah.
It's the 602 is the actual number.
The 602?
I kind of have a funny story about these. Eberhard Faber stopped making them in 1998. And then a friend of mine, Mr. Jalopy, and I were aficionados of them. And we would sometimes find stubs of them at garage sales and stuff.
Oh, my God.
So we thought, let's find out what the deal is. So we found out that Eberhard Faber, the reason that they stopped making it was that the ferrule machine, the thing that makes that unique kind of square-shaped eraser holder, broke. And they just said, forget it. So we contacted California Cedar Company, and we said to the guy, we'd love to you know, have you make these pencils for us, and then we'll make them, you know, you can make them for us, and then we'll sell them and read them. And so the guy said, well, you know, we have to find the licensing and blah, blah, blah. And you guys have, so we ended up like dropping the ball, Mr. Jalopy and I, just because it was like, we were busy, Make was starting up.
No like way.
A year later, California Theater started making the pencils. And it's like, I don't blame him. I mean, I applauded him. I, you know, wrote to them, said it was great. I'm so glad you did it finally, because we didn't do it. You know, there's a lot of work. You had to license the name, you had to get the tooling and everything. And they've done a beautiful job recreating the pencil, I think.
And it's still called the same thing, Blackwing?
It's called the Blackwing. And it's got the same color, the same logo, half the pressure, twice the speed. I've tested it against the Blink 602s I have from Eberhard Faber. And I think they got the graphite formulation down pat. And I think Susie's right. You do want the one that's kind of the pearlescent gray finish of the pencil. That's the preferred one. And it comes with a black eraser. That's the one difference. You can buy the pink erasers for it too, so that it looks almost exactly like the original.
Well, you know, another thing about these, they do limited editions. I don't know if they do it every year, but I have one that they did in honor of Dorothea Lange, the famous photographer who took so many classic photos during the farm labor project during the Depression. And I love that they do that. And, you know, and of course, they've created a cult among us who want to have the latest box of special limited run editions.
Yeah,
and
sure.
It reminded me, these pencils are superb for writing on the back of photographs. You know how photographic paper, you know, it's hard to write on. It just is. And and if you have, one of these soft, that's what I mean. This pencil has never met a texture that it couldn't write on. Even as I'm talking to you, I'm sitting here like doodling on my desk. I can put this pencil on anything and make a discernible, gorgeous mark. In fact, I don't know why I feel so, it's just the best.
That's really, yeah, it's really so great. Well, I'm sold. I'll take 200 of them. So tell us about another favorite tool of yours.
Okay, well, the tool that I am the most associated with is the very one that I have probably sold more of myself than anyone on earth, and that is the Hitachi Magic Wand. This simply is the magic machine that has turned more women onto the experience of a real live screaming orgasm than, you know, anything. It's remarkable. The first time I encountered it, I was in San Francisco. It was, I guess, 1980. And a friend of mine said, yeah, there's this therapist who has a feminist vibrator store down the street in the Mission. She wanted to have a place where women could get a vibrator where you didn't have to go to a dirty bookstore and, you know, you could get something that worked. So I toddle on down there. I met Joni Blank, the owner. Joni just passed away a couple of years ago. And yeah, sure enough, she was this philanthropist who started working in her therapy practice with a lot of women who, you know, like everyone who read, you know, the usual propaganda, they were naive. The first time they had intercourse, they thought, oh my goodness, you know, the man will say that he loves me. He will place his penis in my vagina and I will come. You know, it's going to, you know, isn't that what's supposed to happen? I mean, that's what happens in all the books. And much to your, you know, biological amazement, you find out that your clitoris is not your birth canal. And there is, you know, if women could come from having their birth canal stimulated, we'd never be able to have babies. I mean, you know, like, you can't, the birth canal needs to be a place where you can tolerate a lot of pain and where, you know, you have some distance from the sensation. There is no way that the inside of our vagina is going to feel like the tip of a man's penis. You know, our clitoris is the one that is the analogous. So, okay. Huge, you know, people are like, oh my God, well, here I thought it was just me, that something was wrong with me. Okay, so it's interesting that heterosexuality is set up in such an, you know, kind of a slightly tricky way, that the thing that might get a man off isn't necessarily the thing that would get a woman off. She needs to touch her clit on some level. Now, with women, the head of your clitoris, again, remembering it's analogous to a man's, the head of his penis, but most of our plumbing is on the inside. Like, we have an internal body to our clitoris, but you can't see it from the outside. We, you know, it's like indoor and outdoor plumbing. It's just so different. But the way that we can touch ourselves on the surface that feels good is around the area of the clitoris. Now, you can do that with your hands, of course, with fabulous success. But some people, you know, they just hadn't quite figured it out, you know, or the sensation maybe was a little awkward, or maybe they were so ashamed, you know, from all the religious and social training they had. Well, after I met Joni Blank, I start working at Good Vibrations. And I remember women would come in. At that time, hardly anybody came in the store. I'd have maybe two customers a day. And they would be so feeling so sad. Some of them would say they were there because their doctor had told them to. I mean, it was really like you were crippled, like you just discovered you were, you know, disabled. And they'd come in and I would say, well, you know, this one is plugged in. Just hold it outside of your jeans for a second and you'll know right away whether you want it. And they, you know, be like, how dare you, you know, asking me to perform an exhibitionist act. And I'm like, well, you know, feel free to go back in the bathroom. It's fine. But honestly, I'm going to turn away. I'm going to go back to the cash register. You're going to put this Hitachi magic wand on the front of your trousers. You're going to turn it to on for 1 second, as in 1/1000. And you are going to know whether you like it or not. Sure enough, I'd turn my back and they'd go, oh my God. and you know, and it was like sold, you know, like, okay, great. Of course they were, you know, they weren't very expensive back then. I mean, frankly, they could cost $1,000 and I'd still say it was worth every penny. And I remember for me, I already knew from my own, you know, solo practice and from having some good lovers, you know, that such things were possible with hands and so on. But I was one of those people who was like, gosh, you know, I really envy people who can get sexually aroused really quickly and reach orgasm very quickly. And I wish I could do that. I want to be a premature ejaculator. If only I knew, you know, I would love to. I always feel like, you know, it takes 2 hours, before I reach a climax. And I remember the first time I took a magic wand home, I just sort of locked myself in my room and I had these races, you know, to see how fast I could like go whoop, you know, zip. And it was sort of like the opposite, you know, you always hear about especially young men who are like, oh, I'm so embarrassed. I wish I could last longer. I didn't want to last longer. I wanted to see what it was like to just be overwhelmed, you know, to feel like I couldn't resist. It really is a consciousness raising experience when you feel like sexual satisfaction is elusive to you. You feel like everyone else understands something about themselves and that you don't. So I sold thousands of these and many people would, you know, to this day, like I'll be somewhere talking about, you know, a completely different subject. You know, I'll be talking about immigration reform and somebody will come up to me and say, you sold me my first magic wand. You changed my life. I'm so grateful to you. I feel like, you know, you should be up there with my first lover or something. And I know what they're saying. I felt the same way. I felt that grateful.
Well, I had a question about the tool itself. And that was in the very beginning, was it designed for this, or was this actually Hitachi had made it for something else? And then Joni and other people figured out that it was actually really good for this and it was sort of hijacked? Yeah. Or what was the origin of the actual
wand itself?
Yeah, you know, Joni Blank and Betty Dodson, who was another person who popularized the original magic wand, they both went to Japan to try to get these answers. And I wish that they had been fluent in Japanese, because they didn't get the answer out of the notoriously tight-lipped Hitachi. I mean, Hitachi makes so many tools. And maybe you could tell me whether all of their tools have such a high reputation. I don't know. You know, I know they make lots of things. But they, the Hitachi Corporation said, we, you know, no comment, no comment, no comment, no comment. They would never acknowledge that this had a sexual use. They were afraid of being closed down on it legally. They, if anyone talked to them, they insisted that it was for massage. And, you know, it's not bad for massage, but if I wanted a massage, I would, you know, go to a real person who would do some body work with me. And in the last, you know, I think, was it like 5 or 6 years ago, they actually said, we don't even want to deal with this anymore. And they sold the name Magic Wand to a company called Vibratex that now does all the marketing. And if a lot of us were nervous because we were like, oh no, they're going to make it a crappier vibrator, because a lot of the novelty companies in the United States did knockoffs that were terrible. I would feel so angry because I was like, this is giving people the wrong idea. This feels like, you know, it was real weak tea. You need a certain kind of, this is a motor driven vibrator. This is not a joke. This is not a double A battery. And even today, some people have said, oh, do you like, you know, there's now a rechargeable version so that you can have it without the cord. And I'm like, you know, I tried that, but you know, frankly, the moment when you are screaming your head off and suddenly the vibrator goes dead because the battery wasn't recharged is not a moment you want to see an angry woman. It is not. I would say get the corded version, plug it in. I mean, a lot of people, and then some people are saying, oh, do you mean you actually use this with a partner? Of course you do. Of course you do. I mean, the most delicious thing in the world is to have intercourse and use the vibrator at the same time. I mean, that everybody knows it's like ice cream and hot fudge sauce. You know, it's the funnest part if you're going to be with somebody else. So, yeah, the Hitachi has remained utterly stoic. I think we really needed some sort of embedded Japanese feminist to get to the bottom of it, and we've never had that person. And the two, people who attempted just, you know, they couldn't break through the language and cultural barrier. We do know, I mean, I was the first person to I brought in the rabbit vibrators that people, you know, became famous through the Sex and the City TV show. And I remember when I met the fellow from Japan, he brought them to me first at Good Vibrations. He heard that I might be somebody who might take this seriously. And he showed me these funny little, you know, battery operated vibrators that looked like adorable pandas and squirrels and bunnies and rabbits and so on. And I said, these are really cute. And they are the classic example of kawaii. And they are in great colors. And women will love these. They, you know, because they're so sick of these cadaverous examples from the U.S. novelty industry. They'll love this because they look playful. They look whimsical. They make you smile. They don't have the same vibrational impact as a Hitachi magic wand, but I think they're going to do fine. So yes, you know, let's bring them in. And I asked him, how did you come up with this idea of making something that was adorable, you know, that had a playful imagery to it? And he said, well, that wasn't our idea at all. We were looking at American sex toys, and they are all very, you know, like, this looks like a penis, you know, well, this looks like an even bigger penis, you know, like they were all very graphic. But in Japan, there's very strict laws that say that you cannot sell anything that resembles the human genitals. So we made these as a way to get around obscenity laws. It was not our first choice. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Wow. So is the, now that there are other ones being made, is the Hitachi Magic one still the best one?
It is.
I mean, you're saying it's kind of like unchanged, but yeah, and despite all the other innovation.
Well, the important thing I need to tell your audience is that Hitachi has taken their name off of it. It's just called the original Magic Wand. And I sent you guys two different links. So make sure you get, quote unquote, the original Magic Wand, because unfortunately in the sex business, because people are so embarrassed and so, you know, unlikely to call the Better Business Bureau, there's a lot more fraud. There's a lot more, you know, con artists operating. So you have to be very careful that you get the original. I would recommend the one that plugs into the wall. Don't be uptight about the cord. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. These things last forever. They never break. I have the same one I got in 1980. It purrs like a kitten. It works. I mean, I've bought other ones over the years just because I feel like I have to stockpile them like some kind of crazy survivalist.
But, like grappling pencil. Yeah.
For the apocalypse, you've got your already.
Yeah. Plus, I have to have one in the guest room. I mean, I have to have one in every room that somebody might be sleeping. But the fact is that the first one I got works as well today as when I bought it. And how many tools can you say that about? Tell me one.
Okay, that's really great. So the Hitachi, the original Magic Wand.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Don't try to find Hitachi.
All right. Well, I don't know how we're gonna follow up with that one, but without being anticlimactic, no pun intended. But let's talk about your heavy duty kitchen riser.
This is what a segue. Okay. I think the only thing that you could leave sex for would be food. Okay. So let's talk about a different kind of appetite.
Okay. Fair enough.
I am an Irish Catholic socialist, right? So nobody expects me to make classic Eastern European latkes. No, you know, unless you're already my friend. You know, who would think to call Susie Bright and say, it's Hanukkah, where are the latkes? But in fact, all of my friends, no matter how they were raised, bow down before me and say, you know, it's sad but true. Susie makes the best potato pancakes in the whole world, and we do not know her secret. Well, now they know my secret because I have told on myself. But the reason why, and you know, can we just talk for a moment? Potato pancakes are just the best. I mean, they're so good. They're so salty.
Yeah, they're really good. I love them.
You know, it's right up there with like the potato chip, except it's warm and it's crisp and soft inside. And it's got a little bit of onion. And then you put lots of salt and pepper. And then you put on the sour cream and your head just explodes. It's so good. You know, my dream date would be eating a big plate of potato latkes while writing a letter with my Blackwing pencil. You know, it's that would be fun for me. So when I first made potato pancakes, I was really disappointed with the results. I was like, these are watery and weak. They aren't flavorful. What am I doing wrong? And it took me some experimentation, but I realized that potatoes, and there's other vegetables like this too. I would say zucchini is the top culprit. They are watery. And usually in a recipe book, they'll say something like, oh, you should put these in a colander and let them sit for a half an hour, or you should salt them and let the water seep out. Well, you know what? That doesn't work. You know, maybe if you have 14 days to let the water drain out, but no, I mean, it's time to make latkes. You have a lot of people to feed. So what you do is you get one of these, get the industrial ricer. There's a lot of crap ricers. The only ricer I want you to get is the one that I gave you the link to. It's great because you can put it on the edge of your sink and just use torque to press all the water out. You grate your potatoes, stuff a bunch of them in the ricer, you know, a couple handfuls, and then you press down and kaboom, you know, all the brown water expresses itself. You then take your nice, you know, expressed fresh, crispy, dry potato leavings, put them in a bowl, add the matzo meal and the onion and the egg, and all of a sudden, you are the most popular person in town because your pancakes are the best. And it's the same thing with zucchini. I mean, there's, you know, zucchini gets used in a lot of different ways, but whenever, you know, like if you were also, maybe you wanted to make some zucchini pancakes, or you needed any of those recipes that says, let the zucchini rest to express the extra moisture, you know, fuck that shit. Just get out the ricer and get the water out. So, you know, it's funny, people call it a ricer. I've never made rice with a ricer. I don't even understand what that means. All I can tell you is it takes vegetables that need excess water removed from them, and it gets rid of it fast. So, you know, sometimes you need to get rid of things. Less is more.
Yeah, that sounds really great. Cool, Susie. What a great recommendation.
Yeah. And so, there are a bunch of ricers, and you're suggesting that this one that you send a link to called My Life Unit Heavy Duty Commercial.
Yeah, this one is the Hitachi Magic Wand of ricers.
Okay.
Exactly. No, at one time, someone, right. I bet you've had other people on the show. This is another great show idea. The time that somebody stole one of your best tools, it's a moment of great anguish.
Oh.
Yeah. And then maybe they say they didn't mean to, or it was an accident, and now they can't find it. But this is what happened to my first ricer. Somebody walked off with it. And I did that thing.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, ugly. Then I did that thing where you go onto Amazon and I just hit the first ricer I saw. I thought they must all be the same. And I got this piece of shit ricer, came in the mail. It didn't work. I couldn't put my elbow grease method using the edge of my sink to press things out. It wasn't easy to put the grated potatoes inside. It was a complete bomb. And I was like, I can't use this. This should not even be allowed to be sold as a ricer. I mean, who's supposed to, you know, get any activity out of this? So I don't know what the name of it, you just said it on the air, you know, what they call My Life. It sounds like it's some sort of Nabokov novel. It's like your memoir, ricer.
My Life Unit, yeah.
Right? But I don't know what they call it, but I looked at the picture and that is the one. Do not accept any other imitations.
Well, this is what we'll link to. It is heavy duty. I mean, we should warn people that it's not small.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, you're giving them the wrong idea. It's not the size of a car. I mean, it's the size of a, you know, I don't know. It's the size of a laptop. It's not a big deal. You can handle it. Your audience is strong enough to handle this ricer. I know they can do it. And this has been so fun. I want to be a repeat guest. I have 4 more tools. I mean,
I love that, Susie. But before we go, tell us about an anthology that you edited called Santa Cruz Noir.
Oh, I'd love to. That's very sweet of you to ask me. I live in Santa Cruz, California, which I think has a bit of a mythic status in the rest of the world. We're known for our surfing and the redwoods and the beauty of the surroundings. And a few years ago, I started working with a small publisher in Brooklyn called Akashic Press that has revitalized the mystery genre by doing dozens of anthologies that are set in different cities. Like they have LA Noir, Brooklyn Noir, Hong Kong Noir, Omaha Noir. You know, they go all over the world, and they put together a set of, say, 20 stories taking place in different neighborhoods that usually feature a murder, you know, or some tragic event, perhaps a little existential angst, but they all are within the noir genre. And I produced about 40 of Akashic's audiobooks on this subject, and I loved them. I loved casting them. Oh, it was so good. I love the film genre of noir. I love mysteries, you know, Ray Chandler, MacDonald, Dashiell Hammett, you know, that's where I live. So this stuff was my meat. And at first they resisted me doing Santa Cruz Noir. I mean, I said, come on, you know, I've done a million anthologies. And yes, they did know that. Oh, let me do Santa Cruz Noir. And they kept saying, oh, Susie, it's too small. I would just enrage me. And then one day they sent me a copy of Oakland Noir. And I was like, Oakland? Really? Really? Why don't you drop dead? You're sending me a contract tomorrow. And he did. He sent me a contract. And one of the things I really liked about it is when you live in a town that is known for being beautiful and perfect and, you know, like everyone, you know, millions of people come here as tourists to fall in love and have an experience. What you don't hear about is the working class life of this town. Mm-hmm. You don't, I mean, occasionally we've been in the news. In fact, in the 70s, we were the serial killer capital of the world. You know, occasionally there'll be some shocking crime, but you don't have to go back in crime history to see the dark side of Santa Cruz. This is a town that that has, you know, the opposite side of the tracks. And one thing I loved, I've never done a book about the place that I lived, you know, where I would show my book, I showed the galleys to cops and DAs and cab drivers and bartenders. And I'd say, what do you think of this? And at first they kind of didn't believe it, you know, because they're the invisible people. And then they would look at one of the stories and they would go, holy shit, this is the real thing. You know, the ugly side of surfing. I also could have done a whole book called Gentrification Noir. I mean, the ugly side of the working class being forced out of our area because you've got tech executives and then people to wait on them for minimum wage and everybody else can go fuck themselves. We have all that. We have, and of course, we have colorful crimes. We have, you know, we're one of the birthplaces of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So we have all that too. But it was really a blast. I got the whole town got involved. The local museum had a mystery scavenger hunt. The libraries put on a show. I got to meet people I never would have met otherwise. And I certainly got to hang out with the best writers in this town. And we have some incredible writers. So Santa Cruz Noir is my latest book. And I think anybody who's listening, if you enjoy reading mysteries or you have a penchant for noir, you're going to like this book. In fact, guess what? I got my first royalty check today. It earned out. Oh my God. That's that, you know, great. For any author.
Wow.
I know. Big prize. Awesome. Yeah.
The way that works for those listeners who may not know is authors get an advance, which is really an advance against the royalties. And then when your royalties catch up to the actual advance, then you earn out and you begin to earn new.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which, you know, so 99%, that's 99% of authors never see a royalty.
Right. Exactly. Right. You never earn out. So congratulations. That's great news. It sounds like a great book.
Yeah. Susie, I just have to ask you, I'm talking about Santa Cruz and its world in fiction. What did you think of Jordan Peele's take on Santa Cruz in the movie Us?
Oh, you know, everyone is so thrilled about it here. We've actually been the site of a few different movies, and I have lots of friends who got to be extras. And cool. It's always, yeah, kind of pandemonium in town, you know, like, oh, you know, they need a bunch of, you know, hippies. And you know, of course, you know, 1,000 people show up. Yeah, great, we can do it. It feels like a revival. The last time there was a movie shot in Santa Cruz that included our amusement park, which has been around for over a century, our little boardwalk on the beach with its beautiful roller coasters and so on, was The Lost Boys, which is a totem here.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Yeah, if you live here,
yeah,
you sort of have to...
Santa Carla, they call it.
Yeah, they called it Santa Carla, but everyone here is very attached to that film. And the last thing you would have thought was, you know, Jordan Peele. I mean, he's not from here. You know, it's brand new. It portrays a Black family that goes for a summer vacation and everything goes a little crazy. But I would say it's a big hit with locals, especially the young people who feel like this is our Santa Cruz and they love horror and they totally appreciate. And in a way, I identify with it in terms of the book that I did because it is showing a different side of Santa Cruz, right? It's showing the other side of paradise. You know, I just can't resist because I always want to show the other side of paradise.
Sure. So we'll have a link to your book. Is there somewhere else that people can go to follow you? Or are you active on any of the internets that people want to follow? Where would they go?
Where would they go? Well, you know, you can always go to my blog, which is susiebright.com. You can always find me on Facebook at facebook.com/susiness. Can I read you the very last 5 lines of my book? Because I think it kind of sums it up.
Of course.
It's so good. It says, one afternoon, a couple of my weekend visitors walked in the back door with a happy sunburn and a Foster's Freeze ice cream in their hands. Oh, wow. If I lived in a place like this, they said, I'd wake up with a smile every day. Oh, yeah, we do. Thank you for that. There's no beauty like a merciless beauty. And like every crepuscular predator, she thrives at dawn and at dusk. You're just the innocent we've been waiting for with your big paper cone of sugar tart cotton whipped out of pure nothing. We have just the ride for you, the longest tunnel ever. Santa Cruz is everything you ever dreamed and everything you ever screamed. In one long drop, you'll never forget.
Wow. That's you should be a reader for audiobooks.
Oh, really? You think?
Well, Susie, this has been so great talking to you.
Yeah, it's really, really been great to hear your voice. We're really, and we definitely cover territory that we don't usually, so that's really great.
Thank you.
I'm so glad. Please have me on again, or let my husband come on because he's crying that he doesn't get to be on with Grandpa's toolbox.